The following talk was given by Steve Matushak at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on May 17, 2025. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning.
Morning.
Welcome. And thank you for sitting, Sishin. A number of you are probably aware Sishin almost didn't happen. Your being here, you are Sishin. I know I say this at every Sishin, but this is true. Our practice is doing. It is not an abstract teaching. It can be treated that way pretty easily, but it's not an abstract teaching. It's a doing. So when you're doing Sishin, there's Sishin. When you're not doing Sishin, there's not Sishin. That's really what happens. You know, so I appreciate your being here, because your being here is Sishin. So we have Sishin. You know, I think about, again, how easily this can seem abstract. And there's going to be a teaching that we're going to address in my talk today. Something, emptiness. And emptiness can seem very abstract to us. It can seem philosophical. But emptiness is not an idea. I mean, that's not, it's a teaching, so in that way it is an idea. But the teaching that is pointing to is not an idea, right? When emptiness is an idea, then our whole world becomes that idea. And you can substitute any idea for this. Our whole world becomes an idea. And then what we do is we'll act out of and say things out of and think out of that idea. And inevitably, we'll sow harm and we'll sow confusion as we act out of that idea, speak out of that idea, think out of that idea. But when we see emptiness just as thus, when we see that, then everything we do is just an expression of emptiness. That's it. Nothing extra, nothing outside of this is needed. You don't have to hang on to the idea of emptiness to act out of, to speak out of, to think out of. Just when you see it thus, then there's just a natural expression of emptiness. That's our practice, right? That's it right there. We don't have these ideas. We'll have them, right? It's probably going to happen while you're in Sishin. Maybe you come to Sishin with an idea about Sishin. But one of the great things about Sishin is Sishin will kind of take that away. You have an idea about what this is, and Sishin will go, yeah, no, not that. You know, I got a new cat recently, and I was bragging at coffee about what a relatively well-behaved cat it is. It does like attention, but it's pretty well-behaved. I mean, he can jump up on the counter. He showed me, because he did it, where the food is, but he doesn't get into the food. He just gets back down on the floor and he meows and 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 meows until you feed him or you distract him in some way so that he stops bothering you, right? But what he did yesterday was, I was going to have breakfast, and my husband will make a smoothie for us on Friday mornings before he goes to work. And I had my smoothie out, and I was sitting down to have a cup of coffee and a smoothie, and then a cat came over, and the little tray that I had my smoothie on, the cat has been doing this every once in a while. He gets under it as part of playing, and he's playing with a toy mouse, and he kind of gets the mouse under the legs of the tray, and then he kind of swats it around, and he's on his back, and I was watching my coffee splash around, and I went, better move that coffee, and I picked my coffee up. Just as I did, he kicked at the table with his back leg, and my smoothie just went over everything. It went over everything. So I had an idea about what my morning was going to look like. And then there was how my morning actually looked, which was there was blueberry in that smoothie. So, looking at the floor going, am I going to be able to get that out of there? So, I did as good a job as I could. But Sishin is that same way. You come in, you might have expectations. It's the same thing with our practice. It's easy to make this abstract and make an idea out of it. And I say that because in a way that's what, you know, Steve is going to be addressing from a slightly different angle than he has through a lot of this book. So the chapter that I'm going to be talking about, and I've been speaking about chapters from Steve Hagen's book, Buddhism is Not What You Think, for the past few years in Sishin now. And I really am getting to the point where some of the chapters are a little hard to talk about. Like there was one I went, oh, this looks like the perfect length. And then when I read it, it was a page of teaching and three pages of a story. And I went, well, not really a lot to talk about there. And this one I'd been kind of avoiding just because of the topic, even though when I started reading the chapter, I went, oh, this is good. It's called Rebirth, Not Reincarnation. Right? So when you hear that title, one of the things about Steve's titles is they can often stop you for a moment. And this one starts out, it just says, not reincarnation. That's the first thing it says. And it's kind of provocative because reincarnation, that's like one of the key teachings in Buddhism, isn't it? I mean, that's kind of was certainly my understanding before I ever came to Buddhism. I knew that it was also Hindu, but I understood it as a Buddhist teaching as well. And had I only seen the movie Kundun by Martin Scorsese, which I, by the way, I've heard, you cannot see that movie anymore because Disney has pulled it out of distribution in agreement with the Chinese government. So I guess Disney wants their profits. So, but anyhow, so Kundun, if I would have seen that, I'd for sure reincarnation, because that's part of the story of the movie, is that little boy. And they set all those artifacts down in front of him, and he starts picking out the glasses and these other things, and he picks out enough things that were his from a previous lifetime, and they go, this is the guy, this little kid, he's the Dalai Lama, right? So, but Steve says, not reincarnation, right? I taught some sixth graders recently, just teaching them sort of about how the practical aspects of this teaching in our lives. And of course, what do? I teach them. I try to teach them emptiness. But I did it in a way that I thought kids would understand, because emptiness, really, impermanence, that's not so hard. Now, I thought I was getting older kids, so I thought I could talk to them about this stuff. And as I started talking to them, and a minute into my talk, I realized that not a single one of them was listening to me any longer. I just went, well, this wasn't a good plan. But impermanence and interdependence, right? These are two things that anyone can see. A child can see this stuff. So I was going to teach them emptiness, and they just sort of, you know, stopped paying attention. But anyhow, I'd asked them at the beginning, well, what did you learn about Buddhism? Because I was kind of curious what they were bringing in. And one of the things they learned was reincarnation. Maybe the second thing somebody said, reincarnation. And I wrote that down. So I had my list of things, and none of them were anything I was going to talk about. And I said, well, these are all good, but we're not going to talk about any of that today. And we did sit in meditation then, which was also interesting, a group of sixth graders. Because I was like, well, we're just going to do, in my mind, I'm thinking, we're just going to do the 5-minute sit that we usually do at meditation instruction. And again, within a minute, they were just squirming all over the place. And I thought, no, I'm going to stick with the 5 minutes. And then I want to see how they felt. And I don't think there was a single student that could sit still after a while. And there was one kid, I looked at him and I went, he's going to be the first one that's not going to be able to sit any longer, right? And I was right. He was suddenly sliding all over his cushion. But I asked him at the end, I just said, how many of you thought that was easy? No, they all, not a single kid could. But reincarnation, one of the first things they told me, that's what Buddhists believe in, is reincarnation. Steve says, not reincarnation. He says, rebirth. Well, what's that? What's rebirth? So there must be some difference between rebirth and reincarnation. That's what it looks like, rebirth, not reincarnation. And if that's true, well, what is rebirth? And, again, I'm just looking at this title going, what do I think of when I see it? You know, and then is rebirth better than reincarnation? Is rebirth worse? Because I do that all the time. You're going to give me two ideas, I'm going to go, well, one of them's got to be a better idea than the other, right? So which one is it? That's our title. Now I'm going to just kind of go through a couple paragraphs at a time. One common misunderstanding of Buddhism is that it involves reincarnation. But if we go back to the original insights of the Buddha, we don't find this teaching. What the Buddha taught was rebirth, not reincarnation. Though they are often confused, they are not the same at all. Our usual understanding that we're born, persist for a time, and then die creates a big problem for us human beings. We become frightened of our own mortality. The notion of our death fills us with anxiety. We want to know what happens to me after I die. Where do I go? Or do I simply vanish? All right. So right off the bat, he says one common misunderstanding is that Buddha taught, or that Buddhism involves reincarnation, but that the Buddha didn't teach reincarnation, instead he taught rebirth. But then he doesn't tell you what the difference is, probably because that's what the rest of the chapter is going to be. But he doesn't get to rebirth until like the last page. So I'm just going to really quickly give you an overview of this, knowing that I don't know a lot about the technicalities of reincarnation or teachings on reincarnation or rebirth. I did think maybe 5 years ago or something, somebody put out like a scholarly book about reincarnation and Buddhist teachings, and I went, oh, that might be interesting to read. But I just never really pursued it. It hasn't really been that gripping of a topic for me, and I just never really thought about reincarnation before I started this. But I know a lot of people do. My mom. I don't really know exactly what religion my mom subscribed to, because when she found out she had cancer, she went back to church. To Christian church that she hadn't been to since she was a little girl. But she talked about reincarnation all the time. So I know that was part of her picture, right? So the difference in essence is this. With reincarnation, you have something like a soul, or if you don't want to go there, like a self, some kernel of self that survives the body after it dies. And then is reborn into some new body. It's reincarnated. Right? That's it, in a nutshell. Like I said, I'm not going to go into the subtleties of it. I don't know the subtleties of it. But that really is it. There's something that's going to move from body to body after death. That's reincarnation. Rebirth is that nothing really passes on. Instead, what we have is each moment conditions the next different moment. And that conditions the next different moment, and that conditions the next different moment. So every moment is new, but thoroughly depends on the conditions in which it appears. And conditions is one of those technical words. You go, what are you talking about? Conditions. I'm going to throw another technical term out, all beings. All beings is totality. It's just totality. But totality is not a particular thing. So totality doesn't it's just not a thing. So when it appears, because it's not a thing, it appears like it's always different. So it looks like this, and then it looks like that, and it might sound like this, it might smell like that, it might taste like that, and then it shows up like this, and this, and this, and this. Never ending, always changing world of appearances. And yet, in that, there's this continuity in every moment being new. There's a sense of continuity. And we will talk about that at the end of the chapters. But that's rebirth. Rebirth is nothing is really passed on. Each moment is born again and again and again and again. And that's the rebirth. It's born again and again and again and again. Now, Steve says that our usual understanding that we're born, persist for a time, and then die creates a big problem for us human beings. And now that might make us pause for a second. We think, our usual understanding? Isn't that what happens? Aren't we born? Don't we persist for a while and then don't we die? And what I think is interesting is Steve isn't denying this. He just says, this is our usual understanding. This is an understanding we have of what it is that's showing up. It certainly appears that way. It's hard to argue with that. You know, we could probably have, I don't know, maybe we've given birth to children. You know, So we know, born, it seems like we're here for a while and then we die. It's just that that's our usual understanding and that's where we stop, right there, at that way that it seems to be. But if we pay attention, we can see that there's something about that that's insufficient to what it is that's actually taking place. That's all. So our usual understanding, we just stop at this one way of seeing it. And once we stop at that one way of seeing it, then we never really interrogate what it is that's going on. But I've been reading Blanche Hartman's book, Seeds for a Boundless Life. In fact, we've been talking about it in practice period. And so I finished reading the book. I just thought, well, we're probably not going to use it any longer because the chapters in the end are a little hard to do that, those talks. And I thought, I remember liking this book. I'll finish reading it. So she tells a story where she went to her teacher, and her teacher was either Shunryu Suzuki, the well-known Zen master. I say either because he was for a while, but then he passed away while she was still a student. So then what I can't remember is who our next teacher was, but I think it was Mel Weitzman, who was one of Shunryu Suzuki's disciples. But regardless, she went to her teacher and she said, "What continues life after life?" And her teacher replied, "Never mind what continues life after life. What continues moment after moment?" That was the answer to his question. So she's thinking this thing about reincarnation, what goes life after life. Well, forget about that. What happens, what continues moment after moment? And at first blush, we think we can answer something like that. Or we go, well, this is what continues moment after moment. But if we can see what Hartman's teacher is pointing out, right, that this is never the same from moment to moment, then we can start to see that this idea that we have that there's something that does continue from moment to moment isn't quite get at what our experience is. But it requires us to stop and ask ourselves, well, what is going on here? What does continue? And to really investigate, to really interrogate that. I'll tell you right now that just experiencing itself is, you know, that change that we're talking about, that it's never the same. So just to help you to see how thoroughgoing this is, right, that we think there's something that lasts from moment to moment, but just experience itself is change. If you just think of it, you having had this experience, and any experience we're having right now, and it could be just you're lost in thought, you know, it could be you're hearing my voice, it could be you're feeling a pain or an itch or whatever it is, you didn't have that a moment before. So now that's what's showing up. And now you're a person that's had that itch. And now they're, you know, and it's constantly changing. That's experience. Without change, which we're going to look at a different way to talk about that in a moment, but without that, no experience. Just no experience. It doesn't make any sense because experience is this changing. We could say to accommodate the change or to accommodate the experience, but it's just experience is change. And Steve is going to come back to, again, this notion of moments changing and changing as the chapter goes on. But here we are in the meantime with our understanding, our usual understanding that we're born, persist for a time, and then we die. And then as Steve says, then anxiety will show up for us. And maybe we don't even realize that there's anxiety showing up for us, because a lot of times what we'll do, and I say this as somebody who, you know, suffered from maybe stronger flavors of anxiety than most people. For me, I remember I started smoking. You know, that was undoubtedly a way that I dealt with my anxiety. How do you start smoking? What a habit. Do you know what I mean? Like, and I remember I had to start out with menthol, because there was no way in heck I was going to start out smoking stuff that tasted like tobacco. It was bad enough. So what's going on? Of course, it's that feeling you get. You're smoking, and it's something to do. I chewed my fingernails all the time too. Smoke cigarette, chew my fingernails. So, and I'm not walking around going, "I'm anxious." You know, I'm just smoking and I'm chewing my fingernails. So we may not even be aware of the fact that we're distracting ourselves. But meanwhile, we've got this anxiety, especially if we're not working with the great matter of birth and death, which is what our practice is. Even if we don't think of it in those terms, that's what our practice is, working with this great matter of birth and death. And if we don't see it as such, if we don't see that that's what we're working with, and again, you don't have to sit there and go, I am working on the great matter of birth and death right now, but it's to actually see, what is this? What is birth? Where is the beginning of this? Where does this end? That's what we're working with. When you are sitting, when you're just sitting, and you're really paying attention, where did that start? Where did that end? And we've talked about this in terms of practice. Where does practice start? Where does practice end? So we're always working on that. But if we aren't really seeing that, and sometimes practice is you're just sitting the posture. Yeah. Well, I gotta do this, you know. Oh, and bring my attention back to my breath. And then you're doing things like having a moment. I don't know what you're doing, but I think we've all had that. Here you go. Oh, this is it. Samadhi, or whatever term you're going to use. I'm one with it, baby. I don't know. But, you know, you're just playing around. You're just playing around. You're not seeing that you're working with this great matter of birth and death. And Hartman, in a different story in her book, Hartman tells a story about she was working with somebody who was facing their mortality. And she says, an encounter with impermanence can make one acutely aware for the first time of one's own mortality. And this can be terrifying. As Master Mumon said in one of his commentaries, and Master Mumon she's talking about is the person who compiled the Mumon Khan, also what we call the Gateless Gate. But as he said in one of his commentaries, you better pay attention to what I'm saying. Or when it comes time for the five elements to separate, the five elements is the skandhas. So when it comes time for those to separate, you'll be like a crab in a pot, scrabbling with all eight arms and legs to get out. Right? And that's just it is. Now, if we actually open ourselves up, we can see that that encounter with impermanence she's talking about, or that Hartman's talking about, she says that this encounter with impermanence for the first time, if we start paying attention, we're going to realize that it's not the first time. It might be the first time it really struck us. But we're actually, in a manner of speaking, encountering impermanence all the time. Here it is. Here it is. Here it is. We just don't pay attention. We don't, but here it is. So Steve says, when we have this great anxiety about death, then we start asking these questions. Well, what happens to me after I die? Right? Where do I go? Or do I just vanish? So it's an interesting question. Where do I go when I die? And I heard a question from a child, and of course children get right to the heart of it. They get right to the heart of it. And it wasn't about death. It was something that Steve told us about, a story Steve told us about, like a comic strip that would explain science to kids. They would write in with a question and then the strip would sort of explain the answer. And this kid wrote in and he wanted to know where the white goes when the snow melts. Wow, that's great. I mean, that's the same thing as where do I go when I die? Same thing. Can't deny that we're seeing the white in that snow, but we all know that that's just a beautiful question. Because what are you talking about? That's not how it works. Well, same thing with I. Same thing with that I. We put that I in there, and now we've made something. We made something out of the white that the white never was. You know, the Buddha was asked 14 questions. This is a story about the Buddha. He was asked the 14 unanswerable questions. And they weren't unanswerable because they were just so, you know, you can't answer them. They were unanswerable in some ways because to answer them is to already buy into where is the white. It's to buy into that. And just to give you an idea what some of these questions are, I wrote down 10 of them. These are the 10 that are the most pertinent to what we're talking about in this chapter. He wrote the questions he was asked. The 10. These are the 10 indeterminate questions. Is the world eternal? Is the world not eternal? Is the world spatially infinite? Is the world not spatially infinite? Is The being imbued with a life force identical with the body, is the being imbued with a life force not identical with the body? Does the Tathagata, that's Buddha, does the Tathagata exist after death? Does the Tathagata not exist after death? Does the Tathagata both exist and not exist after death? Does the Tathagata neither exist nor not exist after, you know, all that stuff. And Buddha's response was what's called noble silence. He didn't answer the questions. They don't really have answers, right? He didn't answer the questions. He said, it's not helping you with your practice. It's not conducive to waking up, right? So don't spend your time here. Come back. Just come back to this moment. Take up this practice. Do the work. And when we do get caught up in questions about this, you know, where do I go when I die? Then practice can go right out the window. You know? But it's if we really look at the question, what the question is, it's positing this thing, the self. Where am I going to go? So I really do have a lot of examples from Hartman, just by accident. This one wasn't even one I heard. It's just a story I remember. I don't know if anyone's ever heard this story, but when a monk asked the master what happens when you die, and the master said, I don't know. Do you remember this story? Anyone? It's a good story. So the master says, I don't know. And then a student goes, well, you don't know. You're a Zen master, right? And the Zen master said, yeah, but I'm not a dead one. And what's great about that is he's taken us right back. This practice isn't about speculation. It's about this. What is this? What's going on here? What is showing up? And in what's showing up, what's really taking place? Is it just what's showing up? Is it separate from what's showing up? Are there two? Can you peel them apart? What is this? So what is this practice? And that's what that Zen teacher is bringing us back. I'm not a dead one. So Steve tells us that with this anxiety, these questions we have, he goes, in response, human beings have constructed all sorts of beliefs and opinions about where we've come from and where we're going. We've created various images of heaven and hell. We have notions of nothingness and oblivion. And we sometimes come up with thoughts of reincarnation. I'll come back as someone else. Sometimes these notions are coupled with the idea that if we're good, we can come back in more fortunate circumstances. An ancient Hindu idea was that if you're really good, you can come back as a god. Many people, including Buddhists, believe that if you're pretty good, but not top-notch, you can come back as human. If not, you might come back as an animal or a plant. And if you've really blown it, you might come back as a mineral of some kind. So we got these ideas, you know. So what do? We get concerned about, we get anxious, and then we start kind of trying to explain what's going to happen. We come up with heaven and hell, right? That's one of the examples that Steve comes up with, heaven and hell. Heaven and hell. And I don't know. I don't remember when that seemed like a bunch of hoo-ha to me, but I wasn't raised in a church, so I didn't have to struggle with that stuff. Do you know what I mean? It was just, what? What are you talking about? I do remember that somebody tried telling me, not tried telling me, somebody told me that, you know, when you die. And I think it was my mom, so again, just talking about what she believed, I wasn't 100% sure of it. She said, no, yeah, when you die, you're dead. That's it. And I go, well, okay, for how long? Well, and then she said, well, for forever. And then I went, what? So I'm going to be dead forever. And then I would kind of, you know, work on that. Like, okay, so what does it mean to be dead? Well, I won't be breathing. So I thought I'd hold my breath for forever. I'd try to do that. And I'd hold my breath. And I'd think, okay, this is what it's like to be dead. This is what it's like to be dead. And then I'd be like, that wasn't forever. Oh, my God. And, you know, the idea of it was. So when I got older, I was thinking, heaven and hell, that's just stories. So what is it? Well, nothing. When we die, that's it. We're out of luck, buddy. You know? And with Steve, what's helpful here, Steve's helping us see that's just another story. It's heaven and hell, it's nothingness and oblivion. There's not nothing. It's one of the things Steve will point out to us. There's no thing here, but can't say it's nothing. Point to nothing. Show me nothing. Where does nothing exist? What are you talking about? So clearly that's just another thing like heaven and hell. Nothing in oblivion. These are just ideas we have. And then, if you want to skirt around those, you know, and again, I always thought nothingness and oblivion was the truth against the fairy tale of heaven and hell, then we've got maybe reincarnation. So maybe if you're thinking, well, it's not heaven and hell, but it's not going to be nothing, well, then we get reincarnation perhaps. I mean, that's a way around that. Now, what's interesting to me about heaven and hell is they also have this component to it that it's moral, right? So if you've been good, you go to heaven. And if you've been bad, you go to hell. Reincarnation, if you're really good, you come back as a god, etc. And if you blow it, as Steve put it, you come back as a mineral of some kind, right? So there's that element to it. And I remember thinking with nothingness and oblivion, I was like, when I believed this, because this is what I thought happened, I was like, well, it doesn't really matter. Whether you live good or bad, right? Or there's another way to think of it. I think it's more the existential one. You choose that. You choose the reality that you're going to live. And there's some degree to which that's true. So there we have it. These are all the ideas that we use to comfort. And you go, nothingness and oblivion comforts? But boy, I was happy to have arguments with people about heaven and hell. And God. I wasn't even an atheist. I never thought of myself as an atheist, but I was not going to listen to somebody tell me BS. I was a little unbearable sometimes, but. So Steve goes on, he goes, what all these concepts, heaven and hell, nothingness, oblivion, reincarnation, what they all have in common is that they suppose some enduring entity incarnate here and now. That persists and after it dies disintegrates only to reemerge as something else again. But there's a problem here. If it becomes something else, then in what way is it the same? How is it still in some manner what it used to be? And if it's not, then how is this reincarnation? Indeed, what does the term it even refer to? That's what's being reincarnated. It's being reincarnated. We have no idea. How can anything both be what it is and something else? Yet, many of us persist in believing that there's this aspect of who we are, this soul, this self, that persists and is somehow recaptured and re-embodied in future incarnations. And I'd say, again, I'd even take that back. Get out of the cosmos. Just come back here. Same thing with here. We think we can change and still be the same person from moment to moment. As I told you, experience is change. It's change. It is change. This experience is always changing, and just to have that experience is to change whatever this we think this was. It's now changing. So Steve is now starting to get at the paradox of reincarnation. Right? Because reincarnation supposes that something is going to be coming back as something else. And it really is a little puzzling. Well, if it's coming back as something else, then it's not that same thing. As Steve says, in what way is it the same? If you're coming back as a rock, unless, Andrew, you're acting, you've been a rock, you know, maybe you have been a rock for your family, who knows? And how is it that in some way, you know, it's the way that it used to be? So I think about something, as soon as I was trying to think of an example, I thought of how collage works. You know, the art form where you take one image and you put it in another image. And when you do that with collage, there was a French philosopher who, the English translation of what he would say was re-territorialized. You would re-territorialize the image. And in doing that, the image would change. It would just be a completely different thing. So even if it would seem to us like we have this thing that's the same, I'm going to take this tomato and I'm going to put it on, you know, the surface of the moon. You know, now the tomato has changed completely, radically. I think of a collage novel that I own a copy of, and it has a French title. I'm not going to try to give you the French title. Nancy, you speak French. You'd probably be able to say what it is. But the translated version is A Week of Kindness. And it's by the surrealist and Dada artist Max Ernst. And what he did is he took these 19th century illustrations for novels and like encyclopedias and dictionaries, you know, the kind of thing with those really thick lines and everything. And those illustrations were not designed as art. You know, they were really meant to be in some ways very disposable kinds of things. They were just illustrations. That's what they were. So they have a kind of quaintness about them after a while. Like to our eyes, you'd just see an old illustration for a novel and it would look like an old illustration for a novel. And we might actually have some appeal for us, like, well, that's kind of cool looking. But that'd be about it. It would feel like something from another era. But what Max Ernst says, he took those things and he made them so that they just pop with life. So it might be like a bed and an ocean is coming, pouring out of this bed, you know, and it just, it doesn't have the moorings to it. It has all the line work of that old stuff. And so it has a flavor to it that we think we know what it is. And then it completely subverts it. So it's constantly making our eyes do things like people have bird heads, stuff like that, you know, and it just looks different. It just stops you. Because that's how collage works. If you take something, you put it in another context, suddenly it's all new. And Ernst understood that when he was putting this. Oh, it's all new. So, again, how is it the same then? You know, because even if you think you can take something and put it in a new context, it's completely different. But what's interesting is, even though we can understand this, we can understand that it does not make sense for something to be what it is and to be something else. We still believe that about ourselves. We still do. We still hang on to that. And you might think of a phrase like, I'm not the same person I used to be. You know? That's like a cliche. I'm not the same person I used to be. I. Or as I restated it, I, right? So I heard another great story about a child. This is, somebody was telling me this about their daughter. Father has a daughter and two sons. So with the older son, who's, I don't know, maybe 8 years old, 9 years old, they're going to see the movie Flow. Do you know this animated movie? It's about a cat. And it's a very adorably animated movie, but it's about a cat that finds itself swept up in what seems to be like a climate event, a climate-related event. It also seems to be, by the way, a post-human world. Where this cat is living. Empty houses and everything. No people around. And a flood just comes in and just sweeps the cat away. It sweeps some other animals away. And the cat manages to get up out of the water. And finally it sees some other animals floating down the water in a boat. Might just be one animal, might be two. I can't remember right now, but... So the cat gets coaxed into the boat. And it's about these animals that have this adventure in this boat. But they don't talk. This isn't Walt Disney cartoon. They actually meow and bark. And you know what I mean? They do the things that the animal that they are do. And they're very expressive. But they don't have hands. They're just, it's just a cat. And it's just a dog. And it's a capybara is one of the animals. And then a bird that I think is a science fiction bird. It was like a bird I'd never seen before. But I'm saying this because the main point was no dialogue. And this guy's daughter, who's, you know, a couple years younger than the older son, so she's, I think she's 8, I think he's 10. She said, I'm not going to watch that movie. Now, if there's no talking in that movie, I'm not going to watch that movie. And she was adamant, so they couldn't watch this movie for all because she was adamant that she was not going to watch a movie that didn't have any talking in it. And finally, this guy was able to get his son to start watching it. She joined them. And she watched the whole movie because you know why? It's a darn good movie. And I don't care how old you are, it's a darn good movie. And so when it was done, everybody loved it, right? And Dad couldn't help himself. He goes, oh, I thought I thought you didn't want to see this movie. You know, and she said, well, I'm older now. And I think that is so perfect, because that kid gets right at our alibi that we have, right? Where we think we're this person. It's how we avoid looking at this really complex thing that we're not the same person. And we say things like that. I'm just not the same. I'm older now. You know, I know better. So in spite of the fact that we know something can't be the same and not, you know, not be the same and still be the same, still be here, we still hang on to them. Steve says, here's what many people miss or ignore about the Buddha Dharma. The Buddha himself pointed out that this view of a persisting self, this view is inaccurate and extreme. It's called the eternalistic view, the view that there's an enduring self, a soul, that survives the body and persists in some fashion, perhaps through reincarnation. But the awakened see directly that impermanence is never found, or that permanence is never found. Permanence actually isn't either. But that permanence is never found, that the eternalistic view simply doesn't hold up. This is not a matter of belief. The awakened don't hold any beliefs on this subject at all. So this idea that there's a self that exists beyond the body, and is reincarnated and exists beyond the body, or just that it's a soul, however you want to look at it. The Buddha saw this as one of the extremes. We have two extremes. One is that, eternalism. The other one is nihilism, that there's really nothing. It's sort of nothingness or oblivion. And the Buddha saw those as the two extremes. And we're in the middle way. It doesn't hold on to either of these extremes. But to see that there's some self that's passing, that there's some permanent self that passes from life to life, is to subscribe to eternalism. But again, think about Blanche Hartman's teacher. And she says, what is this that goes from life after life? And he goes, forget life after life. What is it that goes from moment after moment? Right? So it's the same thing. We think that this is all just about the fantasy of reincarnation or what happens after death, but it's what's happening right here as well. Now, what is taking place here? Now, with this eternalism, one of the things we can notice, so our experience is this, and then it's this, and then it's this, and it's this. But in our experience, we can sense that there's, I don't know, no ending, no beginning. We talked a little bit about that before. You can sense that. But what that is, we can't say what that is. Because we can't pick it up, we can't show it to somebody. It's not of that nature, that doesn't seem to be changing. But Buddhists don't believe that there's this aspect of our experience. It's just right here. We know it. You can sense it. It's just you can't put your finger on it. You can't really say what it is. So we actually do realize that nothing persists, and yet we can't say this is nothing. Those are the two extremes right there. Steve goes on, he says, we need to be aware of our wishful thinking. And this is the need for there to be things of substance. We need to be aware of our wishful thinking, of our leanings of mind, and how we grasp at explanations and answers, especially those ready-made to accommodate our egoistic desires. We need to see how we hold to things, especially to this delicious and compelling idea of me. I love that word, delicious. This delicious and compelling idea of me. And how we're overcome with the intense desire to please, preserve, and protect this dear little self. The Buddha said that to see with right wisdom is to see that nothing holds still but exhibits only thoroughgoing flux, flow, and change. When we see this clearly, we no longer take seriously any notion of persistence. In other words, when we look honestly at actual experience without adding or assuming anything extra, the notion of an abiding self does not occur. As the great 13th century Japanese Zen teacher Dogen Zenji said, just as firewood does not revert to firewood once it burns to ash, so a person does not return to life after death. When we were we somehow to come back, we could do so neither as ourselves, for we'd be someone else, nor as another, for then we'd not be ourselves. And that wishful thinking, as Steve starts this section out, is we need to be aware of our wishful thinking, our leanings of mind. That is hard to see. It is really hard to see. Because we want things to be firm and solid. We really do. And the reason we do, at least I think one of the reasons we do, is there's just a sense that things are firm and solid. It could be just our belief of what it is that's taking place. This is what's going on. To hang on to that is that that somehow is going to be resistant to impermanence. Resistant to that thing that seems to be destructive. So, firm and solid resists impermanence. But there's an image in the Dhammapada, this collection of teachings by the Buddha, where he points out that a house that is built to let the floodwater flow through it actually survives the flood. Unlike a house that's built solidly, which the flood will just sweep away, right? So when we're open, and we just let it flow through, it doesn't create destruction. There's still that flow. But when we think we have built something solidly, that's what gets swept away. It's those seemingly solid things that get taken away from us all the time. If we don't see those things as solid, if we see them for what they are, which is porous and open, then there's no difficulty there. But we will grab hold of concepts as a bulwark against instability. And it could just be simple as, well, it's always like this. I know we do this. And you know, and you may not be walking around going, it's always like this. It's just, you just take it for granted. It's the stuff you take for granted in your everyday life. And it could be a whole bunch of stuff. It could be a situation that you're in. Right? And that could be a relationship you're in. That could be a job. It could be a routine that you do. And you just take it for granted. This is the way it always is. And you hang on to that. That's your safety right there. That's your sanctuary. It's the way you're thinking of it. You've grabbed hold of that. Now impermanence will come, and it's going to take that away from you. So something popped into my head the other day. I don't know where these things come from, and I don't even know what to do with it. I just wrote it down. And as I was writing this talk, I went, oh, well, this kind of sums up the difficulties we have with that wishful thinking and with the desire to hang on to something. And, to be honest, the one that's really hard for us to see that we want to hang on to really bad is me. It's me. It's I. So these words popped into my head. And they sound goofy. They sound goofy to me, but in a way that I think is useful. So W is me. Now W is double Y-O-U. So W is me because I am you for you. Invert the M and we are, I am standing on its head. Or the vertiginous insinuation that I are you. And for me, what I like about this is I think it does a good job of showing us the kind of somersaults that we do when the I is at the center of all this stuff. And we start really looking, but we're hanging on to that. What? And there we are. But that's what we do. We hang on to that I, and then all that, like a rock tumbler. And what makes that sense of me so difficult for us is that we assume it to be true. We assume it to be true. And I looked up the word assume because it's an interesting word. And one of the things it means is just to take up. And we do. We just sort of embody our idea. Like I said at the beginning of this talk, we get ideas about emptiness. And then we're going, okay, you know, this is what emptiness is. Or this is what Buddhism is. And when I'm a Buddhist, I do say and think things like this, you know, and then we do that. And it's the same thing when we take up that me, when we assume that me. But another meaning of assume is to pretend to have or be. This is what we do. We just assume that's who I am. I'm me. We pretend it. We take it up into our body. Because why? Why do we do that? Because look. I mean, look. Here I am. Actually, what it is it's look. What is this? What is this? And then we go, it is me, and I'm doing X, Y, or Z. Right? Maybe a passive thing, like I'm just having this experience. But that's what we do. We look, not really sure what's going on, but we come up with an answer really quickly, and it's me. And when we have that me, regardless of how up front center we can see it, it's always center, but whether it's up front center, but regardless of whether it is or not, we preserve, protect, and please that me. That's what we do. And it's not, none of this is bad. It's just, this is what we do. So if you notice you're doing that, you can see, oh, I'm hanging on to that self. Because as Blanche Hartman said, or as Mumon said, we're not starting to see that we're putting that me, that solid me, that solid thing. Remember what happens with solid things? That's the stuff impermanence takes away from us. Otherwise, it doesn't. Because we can see that there's really nothing there for it to take away from. It just flows right through. But if we think we get the solid things, that's what it takes away. So we get that me. So when we finally get impermanence, it could be our first looking at our own mortality. But we can start to see that we're putting me in the equation all the time. And we can do it based on how we're trying to protect, preserve, and please that thing. Yeah, so it's just noticing that we're doing that. Not scolding ourselves like, there I go again, trying to protect, preserve, and please me. You know, but just to go, oh, that's what I'm doing. I still remember, and I can't remember, Nancy, if you were you in the group when Ebby was in the Thursday morning study group? She was a Zoom, yeah. Were you in? Did you know Abby too? She said that thing that I will never forget because I finally just really put the thoroughgoingness in my head. She pointed out, she goes, you know, we spend our whole lives avoiding pain. That's what we do. And she said, just notice. But that's it. It was like, I didn't realize what thoroughgoing was till Abby pointed out. She goes, you know, did you just move in your chair? You know, did you scratch an itch? And it's that minute. So while we're doing that, what are we doing? It's just an invitation to examine that. That's where we can start to see whether we've assumed that me or not. And we're going to have the somersaults of the W, me, I, R, U, whatever, right? So, as Steve points out, seeing with right wisdom, we see that nothing holds still. There's only thoroughgoing flux, flow, and change. And when you see this clearly, we don't cling to a notion of persistence. Now, this is also important to note. This is really what we experience in meditation as well. Steve doesn't exactly say that a notion of persistence doesn't pop into your head. You know, it's hard for us not to. I mean, it's like if we get ideas about it, about what persistence is and impermanence is, our idea would be something like, well, this floor is not winking in and out of, you know, existence. But again, we got to realize that's an idea that you have, right, about what impermanence is even pointing toward and how that has to do with what you're thinking about there. But if you can actually just, all right, you have a notion of persistence, but now you don't cling to it. That's the deal. Did you just, Dogen will put his dropping off of body and mind. Well, he's not talking about suddenly you don't know who you are. It's like that, I don't remember the name of the movie, but where the person, every time they wake up, they don't remember anything anymore. So they don't remember who they are or who you are, why you're in this room or what this room is, where, you know what I mean? It's not like that, dropping off the body and mind. Instead, it's not clinging to our ideas that we have. So we'll have ideas. We're humans. We conceptualize our experience. That's the nature of this. We wouldn't be experiencing without conceptualization, right? It's part of the package. So this stuff has shown up, but we don't cling to it. If we see thoroughgoing flux, flow, and change, right? We don't have to explain it. You don't have to run around going, well, it appears that the wall is substantial, but you don't have to do that. Just let it go. Just let those ideas go. Just don't cling to it. Once you start arguing with it, now you're still holding on to the idea, whether you think you are or not. If you're arguing with it, you are. And so when we start to see this clearly, we don't cling to a notion of persistence. Then that notion that we generally have of a self that's outside of impermanence, again, that self that, all right, I'm willing to admit I'm not the same guy I used to be, right? I'm not that same person. I'm not. I am. I, you know, get into that. But if we can see that everything is thoroughgoing, flexible, and change, then that notion of that me or that self or that I that's outside of this, it doesn't occur to us. So we wouldn't think that after death, whatever that is, that I'm going to be here, right? And Steve gives the example from the Genjo Koan of the firewood and ash from Dogen. He tells us firewood does not revert to firewood after it has burned to ash. So a person does not return to life after death, right? Where does the white go when the snow melts, right? And does it come back? Does it ever come back again? But if we can actually see what these teachings are pointing to, like the firewood and ash, and why it is that we don't get the firewood back, there's some very basic idea. What we can start to see is that firewood and ash and me and white, they're all abstractions. They're abstractions of what's actually taking place. And we can do that with firewood itself. Just what is firewood? What is firewood? So firewood, at least as far as I'm concerned, firewood is only firewood if it's used to make a fire, right? I mean, is it firewood if we intend to use it? If you've got a pile of it, you've got a pile of firewood, if we intend to use it to make a fire, but instead it rots and becomes unusable to make a fire, is it firewood then? Or let's say that you use it to prop up, like, I don't know, a bin to a storage container you have out at your cabin or whatever. Is it firewood then, or is it a prop? You know? Or was one of the great teachers, I think, took some firewood and used it for the leg of a chair that broke, you know? So then it's the leg of a chair. So firewood is only firewood if you use it to make a fire. Now, some of us could go, well, but yeah, firewood actually is blah, 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 you know, and then we blah, blah, blah. We do the blah, blah, blah. But really, we can see this is all conceptual. That's the only way you can start to have this idea that, oh, is the firewood coming back? What are you talking about, right? I mean, you can see that you're getting caught up in abstracting out reality, in concepts. And then once you've abstracted it out, and again, me is the easiest one to do because we just assume it. You know, it's just, it feels like it's there, then we assume it, and then we don't engage with it unless we're asked to engage with it or something asks us to engage with that sense of self. And sometimes life will do that. You know, you'll encounter something, and it's like Hartman was talking about impermanence. Now you've got to look at it. So Steve, to kind of clarify this, he talks about a lifespan. He says, the fact is, within this one lifespan, as we live from moment to moment, we are never a particular unchanging person. You are not the same person you were 10 or 20 years ago. In fact, you're not the same person you were 10 or 20 minutes ago. Look at the hand holding this book. Even in this short span of time, it's not the same hand, and he's got it's in quotation marks, it's not the same hand that picked it up, the book up. All the blood has been exchanged. Materials have been released and absorbed through the skin. The configurations of bone, muscle, and sinew have all changed. Skin is sloughed off. Nails have grown. Everything about our bodies, our minds, and the world has changed and will continue to do so. Our problem stems from our deeply held assumption that the words you, me, and I, and it refer to some real aspect of actual experience. But the fact is that we don't experience a singular, unchanging self. With some careful examination, we can see this. We can see that the self is a mentally constructed notion and a contradictory one at that. Right? So Steve starts out this section talking about a lifespan. And this is that frame that we use, right, to talk about our life. That's the frame. Lifespan is the thing we talk about. So it's pure, and then I kind of leave this stage that is life, if we think of it in that term. So he's going to take that thing in which we put that seemingly stable self, and then he starts to show us that within that supposedly thing, where there's a beginning to me and an end to me, that we're never the same in 10 to 20 years. Of course, we know the example he gives where he shows a picture of himself as a five-year-old. You know, and when I first saw him doing that, I think he was in the 60s, and he goes, is that me? And we know it's not. And yet we know that that's not quite 100% right either. Right? So we can see there's something there that we can't really pin down by saying yes or no, the way we normally want to do it. But we certainly can see that it's not the same. So we are changing from minute to minute. So thinking about that self that stays the same, we can see that that's not true. So seeing in 10 to 20 years, we can understand that pretty easily. Maybe even 10 to 20 minutes. But it's happening faster than I can snap my fingers, that we're never the same. From millisecond, nanosecond, whatever, however you want to parse it, to the next, right? As Steve says, even your seemingly solid hands, we just take something you don't. Right? It's like I was talking about the floor. Just right here it is. And it's always changing. Always changes. This rock is, I say melting, but it's flowing. It is flowing. I mean, at a rate we can't see at all, but it's flowing. The windows are flowing. You can see that if you've ever been to an old house where the windows have actually flowed. The original glass in there really gets distorted toward the bottoms, right? But they're flowing. It's all flowing. That is the nature of everything. Because there's really not these things. There's just the flow. But our problem is that we deeply assume that that self is substantial, and then we imbue it with a reality it doesn't have. It's something real there, but not how we take it to be. So whatever it is that's showing up, again, this idea of rebirth, not rebirth, but the idea of reincarnation, because rebirth doesn't have that self. But reincarnation doesn't really make any sense. Now, Steve's going to unpack rebirth a little bit, but I don't know how helpful it'll be. It'll be a lot like what I said, though he says it a little differently. And I had to kind of go back over and go, wait, what? The Buddha spoke of rebirth. The full term is rebirth consciousness, not reincarnation. With each new moment, the universe is reborn, so to speak. Rebirth consciousness is the awareness that this moment is not this new moment. The person here is not the same as this person here. The reason this is difficult is you guys can't see it. I'm reading it, but he puts it in parentheses. He's interrupting the words all the time. This person here in this newly formed moment now, nothing persists. Nothing repeats. Nothing returns. Each moment is fresh, new, unique, impermanent. Rebirth consciousness is, and this is the part where it gets a little tricky, I think a little hairy, but he says, rebirth consciousness is the conceptual glue that appears to link all these distinct moments together. Thus, instead of seeing separate frames of a movie in rapid succession, we see what appears to be an ongoing and seamless flow of moments. In other words, this moment looks very much like this next moment, which looks very much like this next moment. But no two moments are ever exactly the same. Instead, each moment presents a newborn universe. And if, it's just kind of mind-blowing to think about, but that's actually what's happening in each moment. And I had a dream once where I felt that. It was a long time ago. It was one of those things where I'd have like some kind of experience, you know, insight or something, and I'd be like, whoa, that was pretty wild. And this one was, in my dream, I was standing on a hill in northern Minnesota. I'd say now, we'll say the North Shore. I didn't know in my dream what the landscape was, but, and I looked up in the sky, and up in the North Shore, you can see the Milky Way, nice and milky. Oh, those stars. Oh, it just makes you go, you can feel, I don't know what it is, but it's not, that our usual way of putting all this together is nothing, you know, in relation to that. It just, so looking up there in my dream, I think there was like a little flicker. That was it, just like a little flicker. The whole thing just flickered. And I understood that the entire universe had just changed at that moment. In a way that I was not going to know, but I was going to know that it had entirely changed. That's the same sort of thing, right? That the whole universe is changing from moment to moment. But our consciousness, the way our consciousness works, it kind of pulls it all together for us. So it doesn't seem like a series of discrete things. So basically what's happening there, what Steve is telling is that rebirth consciousness is seeing the differences from moment to moment. That's what consciousness does. It's breaking out this and that. And it just breaks each moment, each seemingly different moment. And this is hard for us also to grab because moments are just conceptual. So if we really look at a moment, it's going to be very hard for us to figure out where that ends and where it begins. If you look at it, you'll see that. So consciousness sees moment to moment, but it's seeing the different moments. You see, I mean, it actually sees that this one is different from this one is different. So there's this consciousness that kind of pulls it all together. It sees how it is that it's changing, and it gives this sense of continuity. That's rebirth consciousness. So rebirth is every moment is different, and then this consciousness pulls it all together. So we're seeing that each moment is different from the previous one and for the next one. I mean, if consciousness wasn't seeing that, it would just be like, bing! I don't know. It'd be like that guy waking up that I was telling you about in that movie. And he's like, who are you? What am I doing here? Why am I, you know, every moment be like, wait a minute, who? Wait a minute, what? You know? But consciousness is there kind of gluing it all together. So it doesn't feel like that. It doesn't seem like that at all. Nagarjuna, the great second century Indian Buddhist philosopher, pointed out that there's nothing persisting from moment to moment. In fact, there's nothing that endures, even the least bit, to be impermanent. So nothing endures, even in the least bit, to be impermanent. He calls this emptiness. This is the true meaning of impermanence. This observation, which is based solely on immediate direct experience, is simply incompatible with any notion of reincarnation, since reincarnation assumes the persistence of some kind of self or embodied entity. There is no way to hold a view of reincarnation without holding a view of permanence. Thus, any view of reincarnation is antithetical to what the Buddha taught. This moment has been born again and again, innumerable times while you've read this chapter. Learning to see this and not the recycling of souls is the liberation the Buddha pointed to. So Nagarjuna, in his work, Mulamajamaka Karika, the Discourse on the Middle Way, right, he helps us to see this, that there's nothing that endures to even be impermanent. Right? He's helping us to see the thoroughgoingness of impermanence and that this is emptiness. This is emptiness or non-substantiality. And that's what impermanence, teachings of impermanence are helping us to understand. Emptiness itself is just pointing us back to this experience. No, as you say, no emptiness. Emptiness isn't a thing. But without the experience being empty, there would be no experience. It would be impossible. And I think both in terms of interdependent arising, which we're not talking about in this chapter, so I'm not going to spend too much time about it. But if you know that, same thing there, right? This experience is totally dependent on everything else. And it's always changing, or we wouldn't have this experience. It would be impossible. If we actually had things that were sitting around, not changing, you couldn't experience them. It's an antithetical to experience. And so as Steve said, reincarnation would just be impossible. It would be impossible. Now it's interesting because, like I said, there was a book. And I read a review for it, and I think it was a Lion's Roar, Buddha Dharma, one of those magazines. And that person seemed to be arguing, you can't have Buddhism without reincarnation. It doesn't make any sense. The only way you can have Buddhism is with reincarnation. And I went, oh, that's interesting. I just read it and I went, okay. You know, and so I've wanted to read that book, and I don't think I wrote down what it was. And at some point, it's going to be too far back in history for me to be able to figure out which book it was that I was talking about. I used to be able to, every once in a while, I'd go online and go, okay, Scholastic Book on Reincarnation, and it would pop up and go, that's the one right there, I know that's it. But now I'm certainly at the point where I don't think I would recognize it. Because I'm curious to read just the argument. It has to. Buddhism has to have reincarnation. Because it seems to me that what Steve is pointing out is right. You know, ask that Zen teacher, what happens when you die? I don't know. And he wasn't being flip. It wasn't, I don't know. So I don't know. Because I'm not dead. Because that's not what this is about. This is about this. Right now. Right here. The rest of it's speculation. Steve says, just to remind us, we're coming back to this moment. This moment has been born again and again innumerable times. While you've read this chapter, innumerable times as I've been giving this talk, innumerable times as you sit this session, learning to see this and not the recycling of souls or anything to do with that is the liberation the Buddha pointed to. So that's it. So I do think it was a worthy chapter to go into. I had a lot to say. Any questions or comments? Yeah, Andrew.
I was just thinking, it's almost like it's not that this moment has been, what was the last thing that Steve Hagen said, this moment?
He says, this moment has been born again and again,
right,
innumerable times.
Yeah.
Have you read this chapter?
Yeah. So it feels to me it's like this moment. It's gone. It's a new moment. It's the next thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So this moment, it's
new. This moment.
Yeah, it's like you have to kind of qualify it. It's not like there's this one moment that's persisting that keeps changing. It's that some new thing has come in.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
It's this moment. This moment.
Right. But this is relative to whatever that flow happens to at that time.
As you indicated, there are edges, there's no boundaries.
That's right.
So it seems when you, it kind of boggles me to think of moment
That's absolutely right. But you know, it'll have that flavor to it. So what you're describing is one way that our experience is showing up, or if you really start examining the moments, you can't, those boundaries are impossible to determine. And yet, it shows up like this moment. I don't know how else to put it. You know, it's got a particular look, feel, flavor, smell, sound, everything. But yeah, you're right. If you work through it, if you actually start to examine it, whatever that is, and that's what the idea of this moment being reborn every moment, I think it's trying to help us to see is that that moment isn't really that thing you think it is. Because when it's that thing, then it has to have these edges to it, you know, and there's that quality to experience that doesn't have that. Yeah, go ahead, Lisa.
It sounds like rebirth is just what we are.
I'm sorry, what was that?
It sounds like rebirth is just what it is.
I'm still not hearing you.
I'm sorry, rebirth. It sounds like it's just what it is.
Yeah. Yeah, rebirth is, again, it's all, in a way, we're just talking about the conceptual world right now. Because if you think about what Steve said Buddha was talking about is rebirth consciousness. And consciousness is that aspect of awareness that that we have this and that, you know. So it's about objects, really. It's about breaking the world up into stuff, so to speak, to giving it the appearance of having edges. And that's all it has. If we actually start to pay attention, we realize that's not quite adequate. It's not quite what it is that's showing up, but it looks that way. So you're absolutely right, Lisa. When you start looking at moments, yeah, I think I told you I was writing my dissertation and I started trying to describe the present, you know. And I got to the point where I was like, every time I tried to write the present, I couldn't do it. I was like, well, now it's gone. You know, it's no. So I actually came to the conclusion there was no present, which is kind of true. But it's not exactly true. What is this? You know, how do we talk about it? It's now. And now shows up as this moment. Whatever that means, and that's the thing, is it doesn't really, don't hang on to that too much. Because it's just a way we're bracketing this right now. It's just like when he was talking about our life, birth, we're around for a while, then we die. You know, it appears that way. It certainly has that flavor to it. So he talks about dying in here. You know what I mean? But that's not adequate to describe what it is that's going on. So that's our usual understanding. But it's just an understanding. And that's the same thing with moment. If we start to interrogate moment at all, I mean at all, you start to realize, well, what am I talking about? You
know? So in Star Wars, when they're trying to get away from the bad guys, they're in the present moment and they want to get away from the bad guys, so they go to the speed of light or whatever, and you just see this and then you see that thing. I started thinking about it, you say there's no present moment, and how, so in the second book of the Tao it says the speed of light is not the fastest thing, mind is.
Mm. I like that. Because, the other thing we can say is, what they're trying to do is, escape detection in a way? They're going faster than you can see them. Yeah, and the thing we have to realize is that mind, this is mind, right? So try to escape the appearances, and that starts to try to separate then, you know, the good guys from the bad guys, so to speak. But if we start thinking in terms of, you know, the absolute being separate from the relative, you know, the appearances being separate from the absolute. This is the thing with moment. This is why it's, you know, difficult. It's because the two aren't separate. You know, this now is actually never changing. Here is never changing, but it shows up. It's always changing. That's its appearance is never the same, but it's always now. It's always here. Again, I was one of those things that almost sounds like a stoner insight, you know. Hey man, it's always now, it's always here. But you know what? It only feels that way because we trick ourselves into thinking that reality is more complicated than it is. We get caught up in our ideas about it, and then we go, a kid could see that, but kids see a lot of stuff. They see how we put together everything in a way that doesn't make any sense at all. I mean, I just remember that from when I was a little kid. I must have been like 3-4 years old. And, you know, asking adults and you just get these answers and you'd be like, that doesn't make any sense. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. Not just about mortality, but I think I've talked about this before, you know. My grandfather, I don't know why he would do this, but he had this giant garden. I mean, it was just giant. He owned an entire lot of property where he could have built a house and then they could have had a yard around their house. And that was his garden. You know, so it was this big garden. And he had a faucet on his house and he would use that to water the garden. But he would turn that faucet on without a hose being attached to it sometimes. Just let the water run and it would run. As a little kid, I'd look at it and I'd be like, we're going to run out of water. You know, I told somebody, I was like, we're going to run out of water. And somebody said, oh no, water is, you're never going to run out of water. And I was like, that doesn't make any sense, you know. So when you're a kid, you'll hear these things and it just doesn't make sense. because kids actually see, because this stuff is something a kid can understand. Not the way we're talking about it, but they can see the stuff this is pointing out to. I remember having, for lack of a better term, samadhi when I was a little boy sitting in my grandparents' living room. You know, because I wasn't an adult yet. I wasn't doing all kinds of things. So they were just sitting. You know what I mean? It's what it was. So, yeah. So trying to escape this, you know. Yeah. Yeah. That's what we do. Preserve, protect, and please. Anything else?
I don't think Steve brings it up that much, but a critical component to the rebirth consciousness is memory. There's no memory, then it's just this. Mm-hmm. And so now there's a comparison point between this and the memory of what was, that's the right. Benefits abstracted out. Well, that was then, and then there's this, and now I'm comparing it. Well, then there must be a future point. Yeah. That's a further abstraction without the memory.
That's right.
That's a critical component of the
It absolutely is. Yeah, one of the things I was in my talk was just talking about time, you know, and that's the way we understand it. Just what we understand what's going on is it's a time construction. But what is memory, you know? And again, it's one of those things that sounds like, all right, let's pass the joiner on. What's memory, man? But if you treat it like that, well, sure. But if you actually just treat it more like, what is it that goes from moment to moment? What is it? You know, and just as an investigation, what is memory? You know, I wrote an essay about Jack Kerouac, you know, a writer who, I'm not saying he's the greatest writer in the world, but I do think he was a very misunderstood writer, what he was trying to write about. And, you know, when he was writing some of those books that nobody can read, he was trying to write his memory. He was trying to really record memory because he understood that memory was the thing that was happening while he was writing the book. So people think he was writing autobiography, and he kind of was, but he was actually writing about the act of memory in the moment of memory itself and trying to get that. So some of his books, they just kind of devolve into non-words. There's people thought, well, that's that Kerouac. He doesn't know anything about writing. But he was trying to do something really hard, really hard. He was trying to, like, get – there's this you know – stuff going on in our head because, you know, where does language come from? Another one of those things you ask her, where's that coming from? Where's it going? You know, and he was trying to listen to that and record it. So, yeah, last week, Tom and I went to the grocery store and then he was going to record what his brain told him, you know. So anyhow, yeah, memory is conceptual and is very much a part of our rebirth consciousness because it, as you said, It's seeing the difference between those moments. This moment is different from this moment. It's different from this moment. So it has to be able to do that, right? Or that's the way it understands things. And the way that it does that then is that one moment is the previous moment. And now it's the previous moment. Everything's a previous moment. Until you do it. Lisa did. You start looking at it and you go, what doesn't make any sense? Like it becomes like you can't. It's not really like that. It's just like this right here. That's it. And yet we have memory. That's part of this right here. Whatever memory is, you know. My mother-in-law insisted that she remembered things exactly as they were. I don't know why we were having a conversation about memory. It was years ago. I mean, now she doesn't really have a great memory. She's 90 years old and she complains about not remembering. But back then she used to brag about her memory, you know. And I was like, well, you know, it is just how you're remembering. And no, it's exactly how things were. And I was like, why am I going to have this conversation? But I'm going to have it. So, yeah. So memory is another one of those things we take for granted. We think we know what that is. Anything else?
The idea of reincarnation helps me be in this moment more easily.
Okay.
I had a nun in the Tibetan tradition show me a video of like Britney Spears as a 4-year-old singing, and it was like so astonishing how well she could sing when she was so little. And then that was like, it's okay, she was like practicing many lifetimes before this.
Yeah.
Where like it just helps we let go of so many things like talent or I don't know, but like, ideas of what I think I need how much is out of control.
Yeah. Well, that's good. You know, if the teaching's helping you bring yourself back to now and letting go of ideas, you know, about yourself and how things start with the boss, with the chief, you know, and you're pointing yourself and it's really not that way at all. Well, that can be helpful. You know, what Steve is wondering is this compatible with teachings of impermanence, which are essential to Buddhism? And I wouldn't get too stuck in it. I think this, again, is always about how's it helping with your practice right now. If it's helping you to see how your idea of yourself, or our usual idea of ourself, which is this little compartmentalized living in a lifespan, if it helps open that up, great. I think that's fantastic. I really do. But we don't hang on to it too tight. And the only way I could imagine that might show up, I suppose, is if you argue with somebody. Or the people who, when the Dalai Lama is going to die. I mean, this sounds pretty grim, but we have to try not to think too much about it. Who will commit suicide. So they'll be reincarnated as the Dalai Lama, I guess, is the idea. You know, so we don't want to hang on to the ideas. But if they help us really live this, to open up that small self, that's great. Yeah.
Question. When you're done, do the bow, do I take that out? Or do you move it aside and then take the center?
I'll move it aside, and then once everybody's, you know, once the room is rearranging itself, that's when I'll be able to move it. That's the kind of question, like, I wouldn't expect that question, but that's a good question. All right. Anything else? All right. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.